Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
So the Media Project's underway with, well, it's not a supplemental cast. I shouldn't say that.
No, you shouldn't.
We're fine. We're just missing one significant voice. We have, at this point, we call it the publisher, the professor, and the editor. Ira Fussfeld is here from the Daily Freeman in Kingston.
Hello. Good to be back.
Rosemary Armeo, noted investigative journalist, now professor at the University of Albany. How do?
Very good. Also happy to be here.
Well, we all are. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. We are missing Dr. Shartok. Hard to imagine how we'll get by without him, don't you think?
We'll struggle along. Rosemary's been here 4 weeks in a row. It's a palace coup, I can tell.
Oh, no, don't say that. He'll believe it.
Did you vacate?
I vacated a week in California to see my new grandson for the second time in 2 months. So that was fun.
Excellent. So you missed the debut of the new press in the Times Union. So you get to the very important stuff, you know, right now.
I missed it from the sense that we didn't get our first day's paper delivered. And as someone who has installed a new press in my shop, welcome to the club and get ready for a few weeks of sleeplessness.
Yeah, days one and two were beautifully precision. Everything went well. Day three, not so much. There's this interesting, with the term that we use is web breaks, you know, in the press. That is when the paper, what they call it, the ribbon, actually breaks. And we had five of them last night. Now, this just never, ever happens. So
are you there helping to
Oh, yeah. No, they don't want me around.
No, I don't believe the unions would appreciate it.
Do you hear from readers? I mean, I can tell you what my mother said, but do you hear from readers?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, people are very irate when the newspaper doesn't come. I didn't get mine at home this morning.
But today, the initial response to the papers that are delivered has been good.
Oh, people have been really supportive of the new look of the Times Union and the new features. And, I mean, we tried not to be dramatic. We didn't want to tremendously redesign the newspaper. The notion was we want to be cool and calm and collected. And basically, people like their hometown newspaper. I mean, wherever their paper is, they may complain about it, but mostly they like it. So you don't want to do something dramatic and bold because you don't want to alienate folks. So we just tried to do a smart and simple update that focuses on good visuals and storytelling. And so people have been really supportive until now.
Well, it's web breaks. You will experience a lot of them at the beginning. And then when they get it all right and they get the tension control and the liquid and the whole nine yards, you'll have almost none. We used to get them a lot with our old presses, and we got them a lot at the beginning of the new press. And then I can't remember for literally years where we would have web breaks. So there's a light at the end of the tunnel.
One of my colleagues said, well, you know, it's like when you build these sophisticated new battleships, they do have what they call the shakedown cruise, and not everything works just right. And we had expected everything to work just right, you know, and I guess you've got to expect that there's a learning curve. Part of this is human error, I'm led to believe.
And we'll in the meantime, Rex, there's Malox and Adam.
And there are no web breaks in the digital edition.
There are no web, but this is actually true, you know. So speaking of digital, you know, the key thing, of course, as we always say on this show, is whatever the medium, the key thing is the journalism itself. And here now comes the annual State of the News Media Report from the Pew Foundation, which finds that years of newsroom cutbacks have had a demonstrable impact, it says here, on the quality of digital newspaper and television news and in how consumers view that work.
Well, no surprise, right? The question is what happens now? Because the economics are such that the kinds of pressures that have created the fewer reporters at newspapers, and I think the report also cites the similar kind of impact in broadcast, mm-hmm. you know, where is the break that's going to stop this and turn it around?
I've been waiting for this report, wondering when it was going to come out, and it seems to me remarkably bland at the end of the report. They say we're at a point where we have to get back to quality. We are so far beyond that point, and there's no recommendations in here as to how that's going to happen. You've lost thousands of reporters. You're not attracting good new people into the field. What was supposed to happen except exactly this?
Yeah, it is to say that we're at the point of quality. I think you're exactly right. We've all felt what we've lost. In our particular case, we've lost our capacity to cover some of the localness of our community. There just aren't enough reporters to cover everything, so we miss some good stories, naturally. Newsroom employment in newspapers is down 30% since 2000. So a 30% cut in newsroom employment, that sounds about right to me. That's sort of the number that we have in ours. Newsweek shut its print edition. Time is cutting staff. Television, my understanding, I saw a report the other day suggesting that television news is where newspapers were about 5 years ago. The cuts are really just coming.
Hurting. You know, you see it in professionally and in the academy that there are these wonderful new forms for presenting stories. There's a new one out now that's sort of like a video, an animated video, a wonderful way to tell a serious story. And there's Storyfy and Twitter and Pinterest, and they're all very fun and interesting. The problem is there's no content. That's what we keep losing, the idea of finding a story, of figuring out what's important in your community and telling it.
And I would argue slightly about the notion that the quality is down, and I'll speak only for print. I think that the quality of what we do is at the standard or near the standard of what it used to be. It's just we don't do enough of it because we don't have enough people to do it. And where it has suffered, and I would acknowledge there is some suffering, it's because those people and reporters and editors who remain are being asked to do so much more that by that very nature, they can't quite do as well the core material that they used to do. But I mean, I think there's still quality stuff in newspapers.
Well, I mean, it's crazy to say there's no quality journalism. Of course there is, but there is demonstrably less. I noticed
less without question.
Yeah. Investigative Reporters and Editors, which is an international journalism group that has a contest and they attract all of the best print and broadcast journalism. And for years, they kept track of the number of entries, and you're seeing a drop now. For years we said, oh, see, it's still great. Look how many we have. Well, they're not saying that anymore.
Now, I was going to ask Rex, with a newspaper that has made as a strategy, and it's a good strategy, to concentrate on investigative and long-form journalism, that sets you apart and provides quality to the readers. But I presume that it has still come at a cost. In other words, there are still stories that you used to cover that you no longer cover because of the numbers game and because of the amount of time that the investigative reporters spend on their stories. And so I guess the question is, overall, whereas where you're serving the readers well, providing what you provide, are you providing less, thus you're not serving the readers as well? Mm-hmm. And would the readers rather have what you're not providing?
It's very hard to figure out. You're right. Our sense is that the watchdog journalism is what other people can't do, and so we need to do that both because it's the right thing to do and because that's a niche. But here's a real-life example, and it involves Rosemary's students at the University of Albany. We have a major investigative project underway, and we have a senior reporter, very thoughtful person who we've taken off her regular beat to work with this core of students in a major database project. So to cover her beat, we've shifted in someone who ordinarily does sort of short-term hits, who does, I shouldn't use the word hits because it sounds like we're out to get folks, but the fact is these are short-term investigations under our investigations editor, Bob Port. So she is picking up this beat, which then robs us of those short-term projects. And so if you want to do those, then you take somebody off the local reporting beat covering everyday events in Schenectady or Colony or something like that. And eventually there just aren't enough people to move around to cover all the little holes that you're creating in an effort to do what you know is the right thing to do, the watchdog reporting. But boy, it does take it takes time. There's no question it takes time.
Well, and readers want it all. You know, we'll get letters that say, how come you didn't cover the town of whatever last night? And we say, we don't have anybody to cover it, but we had this. Well, I'm not interested in this. And by the way, can't you give me both? And that we, the answer is not anymore.
The Pew study looking at television, which you've noted is in a similar situation, is finding that 40% of their broadcasts now come from sports, weather, and traffic. So in other words, the least difficult to report to get. 40%.
And most of the rest of it is, I'm sorry to my broadcast friends, but, you know, put a good-looking young reporter in front of yellow police tape, and it's inexpensive content to produce. Yeah. It isn't enterprise reporting. You know, with the difficulty, of course, this is a result of a financial problem. The financial problem caused by the multiplicity of outlets where people can go for information, by the limited attention span for the kind of journalism that we do. And so here's what's happening. More organizations are experimenting with charging for digital content as a way to find the revenue. So 450 of the nation's 1,300 daily newspapers, according to this Pew report, now have started or have announced plans for some kind of paywall, some kind of digital subscription model. But there's a hazard to that. And Ira's pointed this out because his company has a different vision and wants to keep access open to the digital side and make it with advertising revenue. So there is no easy solution to this because it's a business problem that is driving a journalism
problem. Yeah, I thought I saw a statistic, and I forgive me if I'm wrong, that digital paywalls produced $330 million in revenue at, God, I don't remember if it was just an industry or it was, I don't think it could have been just the New York Times. Well, that's, but $330 million. And someone said, well, great, that's about what the advertising is at a first quarter. In other words, it's a relative drop in the bucket. And because we in the print business are in such dire need of revenue, we are eagerly, those who are getting it, are happy to get it and are boasting about getting it, as is the New York Times, which claims now that its circulation revenue, including digital, is higher than its advertising revenue. And I just find that that's a dangerous place to be, because advertising has got to be the area long term.
Here's the note that I want to inject in this. We're discussing it as a business model, as a tragedy for our industry, which indeed it is. And that's all very sad, boo-hoo. We're going to not have jobs. But there's something larger at stake here, which is the news and information has been extremely important to the development of this democracy. Mm-hmm. So I have to sound like a social sciences teacher here. And what does this mean? You know, we are not getting information. People are not reading, viewing, listening, whatever other way to get it. They're not getting it because it isn't there. And that is going to have an impact, which we are just beginning to see.
I think you're 100% right.
One of the solutions that we're seeing is newspapers, in order to save money, are cutting back days of the week. Syracuse now only delivers the paper 3 days a week. Another paper, the Washington Examiner, which has been a free circulation daily in the upper demographic areas of D.C. and the surrounding area. The Washington Examiner is no longer going to publish a daily print newspaper. They're going to weekly. This is happening a lot. There is some sensibility that that's a solution to eliminate the high-end, that is the high-cost, low-return days of the week. But the difficulty with that is, of course, then you diminish the habit, the daily news consumption habit, and you may end up shooting yourself in the foot by that.
I'm just trying to think of any other business that tries to boost business by cutting back what they offer, like Macy's. We're going to have less now, but it's going to be really good in uncertain days.
Well, but the counter argument to that, and it's one the history of the industry in 100,000 years will say whether we're right, the counter is that the diminished number of print newspapers that are being sold and have been sold over the last couple of decades, and what we see the demographic interests are of people who are used to, have never seen a print edition and are only no digital and no mobile, that is where they are going and that is where the audience is going. So that as the newspaper readers of today continue to get older and die, the younger people are going to be in digital, and that's where newspapers are going to survive and ultimately theoretically thrive, because when you cut out the print edition or lessen the number of print editions, you're cutting down all sorts of overhead and expenses and delivery costs, and that again, theoretically, is our savings that are going to go back into the content.
The rub that we keep going right over is that those savings buildings are in bodies to put out a print edition. So you don't have the bodies, you still don't have anything.
Well, but the savings would be, the savings that I'm describing would be, contrary to what's going on at the Times Union, would be shut down the press, no more newsprint, no more ink, no more pressmen, no more trucks. And look at all that, millions of dollars, depending on the size of the property, saved. And then theoretically, that is savings that can be poured back into the content. And I think that that is what's going to happen. Although, because so many newspaper companies are ailing, those savings need to take care of past debts before they can start thinking about the new expenses.
Incidentally, the new press, the Times Union, actually cuts our costs. That's the good thing.
I heard that.
We waited so long to put in a new press that now the cost of production on the old press is so high that it makes a really smart return on investment to do this new press.
Even if you sell no extra papers, you're saving money just because the technology is better.
Yes, absolutely. Like a plate. Like every newspaper page has four plates at least, cyan, yellow, magenta, black. And each plate under the old technology costs us now about $7. The new technology, it's just over $1. So we're going to be saving money, which is good news.
Now, of course, the question is, and I'm sure your money people have figured this out, because you now can do such good color, you're going to do more color. And so you're going to have more pages that have color. Thus, you're going to use more plates, theoretically, than you used to. Plus, because you've shrunk the size of the paper but added pages, you're not really saving in the newsprint area. So that said, a lot smarter people at Hearst figured this out already, but that is what could happen and down the road.
But the difficulty that Rosemary points to, I think, is true, that if you don't have the reporters all the time, then when people need the news, you know, if news consumption becomes episodic, if people only go for the news when they know that there's something they want to find out about, and instead of having the daily news consumption habit, then I think we're really going to be in trouble. And this Pew study finds that 42% of adults under age 30 were regular news viewers in 2006. Last year, just 6 years later, that was down to 28%. So from 42% to 28% under age 30 in just a span of 6 years. So we're losing those younger
consumers.
You have
a whole generation of journalists now, the ones who have lost their jobs since 2000, who are working on independence. They're working for no money. Mm-hmm. They're working like they're back in college because they love it. But that's not going to go on. They're not going to teach their kids to do that.
So what do you think the answer is? I mean, if you have the answer, let us know. Write your own ticket.
I wouldn't be here in all the days. Hey, can I make a radical change? I want to talk about whether it is okay for TV reporters, CNN specifically, to be sympathetic to men convicted of
rape.
That's
very interesting.
Whoa.
You want to describe what happened there?
Yeah, this is an interesting story out of,
Steubenville.
Where is it? Steubenville, Ohio. I should know that,
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
Two teenage boys, up and coming stars, handsome, good looking, they are convicted. They actually did it of raping a young woman. And the coverage has all centered on how this has ruined their lives, and the girl was drunk, and man, you know, you have to watch that digital life. They get on these games, and they just, like, lose control of themselves. And the protest has been, well, what about the girl? Why are we so sympathetic to the young men here? So what do you think?
The complaint specifically has been about CNN's coverage.
CNN, and specifically about a reporter with, I think, the unfortunate name of Poppy Harlow.
Poppy Harlow.
Hard to take her seriously.
Yeah.
And yet, if you see her, if you watch her, as I have done, she's extremely earnest. She has reported this story deeply. And her feelings describing what's happening to the young men come out of a place where she's trying to be fair, I think. But it's been really used against her. I should say the mother of sons. But I'm a feminist, so these issues affect me in all different ways.
Do you agree with the complaint? Have you seen the coverage?
I think the coverage has definitely left out the woman.
Yeah, and so then I would ask the question, and that's not to take their side, but I would ask the question, isn't it easier for the CNN in this case to talk about the two boys because they are identified, they are faces, we know about them, and the victim is somebody who is not going to be named.
And they have parents who are out there, of course, want to get the story across. And they are sympathetic. You know, you don't like to see young men screw up their lives, which is what they've done. But they did a serious thing.
The problem begins with the excessive coverage of a single case, I would think.
I was going to say that, too. I wasn't terribly interested in this case. It looked like a local story to me.
Yeah. When I was the editor in Troy, we had a remarkable situation of five young men. The oldest was perhaps 16, who were charged with first-degree rape. paraded in front of the courthouse in cuffs and chains by the district attorney, taking them in for indictment for raping a young girl over a Saturday afternoon and evening repeatedly. All five young men charged with first-degree rape based upon her allegations. And then she called our reporter, who had been covering this, and with her mother sitting in the room, said, "I want to talk to you and tell you that it wasn't what I said it was." Mm-hmm. And our reporter and another reporter went into the young girl's house and sat down with her and with her mother. And the girl said, "Actually, it was consensual. And I'm really sorry about this. I had had a relationship with two of these boys." So the charges were dismissed. Meanwhile, the charges against these boys had been out there. Their names were out there. The young girl's name never did. The choice that we faced was then in her recanting, do we use her name and put her name out there? I decided not to.
Good.
Because obviously she's a poor, confused young thing. But look at what she did to these young men.
And you believe that was the right call? Because
yeah,
I think most of the time when an alleged rape occurs and it proves not to be, I mean, like use the Tawana Brawley, which is not really the best example.
Right.
But if somebody is going to make up a story, why shouldn't their name be
right.
in print?
Here's the thing. I think that rape is one of those cultural issues that news media have an obligation to report about and also change attitudes about. And young people are confused about this. We put them in these highly public criminalized settings. The way we educate is bizarre. How come we're teaching girls to protect against rape, but we don't teach boys not to rape? That goes way beyond the news media. So I think that we should be playing an ameliorating role mm-hmm. rather than a sensationalizing role, which is what happened here.
Do you think, I believe that I'm stating your point of view correctly on this, that you would not generally withhold the names of rape victims because you think that further...
I have advocated for that for years, and with very, very bad results. Every editor I've had has always insisted, even when the woman said, "I want my name out there. I didn't do anything. I want to get that so-and-so." I think that, yeah, we put the stigma, the media puts the stigma on the rape victim that they are somehow complicit. I can't think of any other crime victim whose name we don't use.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, philosophically, I can agree with you. I just find it hard
right.
to get over that hurdle.
And because we made it that way, I mean, what I've always said is ask the woman, do you want your name withheld? They will tell you. Many women will say, use my name. I covered a trial in Akron in the 1980s, and a doctor, a medical doctor, had raped 100 women in this absolutely horrific spree. No one expected that the doctor would do it. It took years to find him. And so when he's finally in court, there was a parade of women in there, thrilled that he was going to finally, they were going to get justice, and they wanted their names used, and none of the papers in Ohio would run their name. Terrible.
I covered one for Newsday about the same time, a man accused of raping his wife in Suffolk County. And because of the policy of not identifying the victim in a rape case, I couldn't identify
right.
the defendant either.
It's always bothered me when you have a conviction in a child rape mm-hmm. case and it's incest. Because then if you identify the bad guy, which it seems to me his name in the paper ought to be the least of, the punishment, you identify the child, which of course you don't want to do. So you either can hide the relationship and just say he was a rapist, or you can say it was incest and then use no names. And both of those things are so so unattractive and horrible.
But typically what we do is we don't mention the relationship. We don't
right.
let it
we
be known that it was
rapist.
A... Yes, we just... Yeah. But people who know that convention that we use understand that in not identifying the relationship between the alleged rapist or the child rapist and the victim, what is happening is that has been that person's child.
And when, to bring it back to the media, will the rules that we're discussing, the traditional rules, change
right.
as the digital
right.
world continues to expand and there are so many places other than the traditional news outlets where this information can be disseminated and that people will not guard against printing
yeah,
names?
What I keep seeing is a move to not using names at all, even when it's material that's completely unobjectionable. I have students go out and do interviews on what it's like to be back at school for the first day. Don't use my name, please.
Wow. So, and by the way, here at the end of what has been a rather depressing program, a moment
wow.
for expiation of our sins. Dear sir, writes this person from the Hudson Valley, could you please explain how it became conventional for newspapers to list Associated Press or Reuters or Bloomberg News in the byline instead of a human's name? I find it to be a little unusual for a story not to be attributed to a person.
Not unusual at all. It's, in fact, many newspapers don't use the AP byline, even if it's on the AP copy. Some newspapers do it routinely. Some people don't. But
I'm sorry about it. You know, I would like it saves space. And the joke in the Associated Press for the photographers is that AP photographer, AP stands for anonymous photographer. Yeah. You know? So sorry. Anyway, well, we've reached the end of our program. This program should be...
We need to admit this singing. Pete Seeger will help with the singing. We were depressing.
That's too bad. So, Ira Fussfeld, Rosemary Armeo, Rex Smith, here we are. Hope you'll join us again next week for The Media Project.
I met a genius who swallows rattlesnakes. Now newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ding, ding, ding.